I have a handout, which is exciting. If you just pass that, I'll have one too, actually. If you just pass that around, that'd be great. I think there's quite a few interesting overlaps, actually, between what's just been said and what I think I'm trying to say in these few comments. You'll notice there's a difference of disciplinary approach here. No PowerPoint for me, I'm afraid. I've written it down. This is what historians do, I'm afraid. We write things down. So if you can bear with me, I shall attempt to make this as interesting as I can. So the title I've set then is Asking the Right Questions, Disaster and Resilience in Modern Cornwall. And I want to start, I think, with some questions and to emphasise as a whole the idea of sustainability as a question, actually, rather than as an answer to a question. I think we often think about it as the latter of those two things, but I think in many ways the notion of sustainability is really posing all of society a question about itself, really. When I do the work that I do on environmental history and around themes of sustainability, I really like to ask myself three basic questions. And in this context, I would frame these questions around Cornwall in particular, but they could be framed more widely. What does it mean, the first question, to say Cornwall should be sustainable, to make that assumption, to make that claim? Whose sustainability are we actually talking about when we evoke the idea? And should we be seeking to sustain what we have? I think this is probably, for me, the core question. Is what we have now really the very best that we can imagine? And there's clear overlaps, I think, with what we've just seen in terms of posing that question and who poses that question. Why such questions, then? Because for me, and this is my own personal view, I have real problems with the idea of sustainability as something that we are searching for in the here and now, something we should be producing by influencing behaviour or attitude, something to be made, in other words. I think this project, if it deserves that name, hides as much as it actually reveals. From a critical perspective, sustainability could be argued to be a conservative ideology. Keeping things as they are, whether it be sustaining the natural or the social world, is very much, I would argue, the project of the rich and the powerful. From their perspective, of course, things are just fine, and we should keep them going very much as they are. Sustainability as an idea, I think, promises to stave off change, to do just enough to ameliorate social and environmental catastrophe, such that our society's main power relations, and I think here, for me, the most important of those power relations would be the class relation, but of course it's by no means the only one, remain the same. On the other hand, for those of us who desire change, and there are many of us, good to see that Ewan is in the audience, appeal to you here, Ewan, those of us who desire change, who really want a fundamentally different and a more just form of society, I think sustainability is actually the enemy. For us, any demand for sustainability, I think, actually always comes too late. For the catastrophe really is already upon us, and thinking about the paper that we've just seen, we can already see some ways in which people are always recognising that all the time. Whether it's the global catastrophe of climate change or the personal catastrophe of food bank poverty, we already inhabit an apocalypse. Future risks and disasters then for us hold no fear, because we are already living with disaster. Indeed, it's this idea, or this notion that I want us to play with just for a moment, that we already inhabit a catastrophe, that I'd like to explore now, looking slightly more empirically at some evidence from an oral history that I did with a colleague who's currently working in New Zealand, Anna Green, on that oral history of the Torrey Canyon oil disaster in Cornwall, which took place in March 1967. Who here remembers the Torrey Canyon going aground? Oh, I'm so pleased to see it. This incident, and I think there's something very interesting about Torrey Canyon incident, in that I think it's both carefully and well remembered, and also carefully forgotten, absent at the same time that it's always present with us. is of interest not simply as an example of an environmental and social disaster close to home, as it were, but also for the way in which those that we interviewed about it consistently critiqued and undermined common academic and governmental notions of what sustainability is all about. And in a moment, I'd be interested to hear what you think about what some of they think about these questions. They point to the reality, I think, of modern so-called resilience, that life under capitalism was and continues to be a life of uncertainty, insecurity, and risk, in which there is actually no choice but to be resilient all of the time. Again, that would be my answer to the last paper's question. Yes, we are resilient, but that's the problem. More than this, they suggest what is really missing, I think, in most discussions of sustainability, radical democracy and revolutionary change. And we'll look at some of the ways in which that arises in a moment. One of the most striking things, I think, about people's memories of the Torrey Canyon going ground, at least those that we came across, was the importance of fear in the immediate aftermath. Apart from the smell of oil, fear was a profound and common memory of the disaster. Unsurprising, you might think, but this fear was not, in general, grounded in concerns about damage to the natural environment or risks to human health, as would have been perfectly reasonable, I think. Rather, it was grounded in economic insecurity, and the fear that the destruction of Cornwall's beaches might spell the end of the tourist industry on which many families were increasingly reliant in Cornwall by the 1960s. One of our interviewees from St Ives remembered going into shops at the time for a newspaper and the owner of the shop shouting, as he puts it, at him, we're finished, the summer is gone. Others recall panic and what they called overwhelming fear that the economic basis of local society was about to collapse. Such fears partly, but only partly, I think, explain the nature of the following response to the incident. The large-scale, and some would argue, I think they're right, excessive use of toxic detergents to disperse the oil, chemicals used to attempt to clean the beaches. The use of detergents, anyone who has followed the results of the recent spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010 or elsewhere will know, was an ecological catastrophe, destroying much of the inshore marine ecology of Cornwall. It did much more ecological damage in many ways than the oil. And there was no extensive baseline ecological research of the shoreline around Cornwall at that time, we're still actually unsure how disastrous the cleanup operation was or how long-lasting any of its effects have been. But many of our interviewees felt that the results were profound and permanent. In short, then, to save a local tourist economy, to address this fear and insecurity, Cornwall's coastal ecology was sacrificed on a vast scale. Yet this deliberate sacrifice, ironically, can be thought of in many ways as actually being a kind of sustainability in action. The key decision that was made was that the central emergency to be addressed was a social and economic one, and this took priority in terms of the state's following response to the disaster. So whose sustainability was being produced in the context of this catastrophe? I'd say it was that of the local tourist industry on the one hand, but also that, of course, of a global oil production and distribution complex. The catastrophic loss of one of the world's first supertankers led to an international legal effort by the Labour government to recover some of the cost of the cleanup. But the fundamental right of giant corporations such as Barracuda Oil and BP to transport such cargoes at such risk to maritime populations was not, and never has, of course, been challenged. As such, the Torrey Canyon remains a warning of the contradictory consequences of following the dictates of sustainability without recourse to the democratic question of what one is choosing to sustain. In the end, the Cornwall of tourism and large-scale marine transportation was sustained at the expense of local nature, the fishing industry, and possibly, though no one, as far as I know, has done any significant research on this, the health of the local population. This choice was never subject to any democratic right of decision, but it's important to remember that it was a choice. In France, for example, the spill was met, the oil also goes ashore in Brittany too, the spill was met with the use of far less detergent and far more labour to clean oiled oyster beds, which were deliberately protected by the decision to avoid the use of dispersants. So there is an option here. Since the Torrey Canyon went aground, we've lived, I would argue, with its consequences, even when we don't remember it. In the short term, much of the oil was dispersed by a combination of huge human effort to clean the beaches and primarily natural action. But the material evidences of the disaster remained and were permanent. Our interviewees consistently recalled the way that beaches continued to show the evidence of disaster through small balls of tar stuck to the bottom of children's feet. The gutted marine life returned, but slowly, with new and unfamiliar crowds of strangely coloured red sea wrack and seaweed colonising the shoreline. For others, marine coastal users of various sorts, surf lifesavers, fishermen and others, there was the memory of all the toxic detergent used to control the impact of the spill and the unknown long-term risks it may pose to human and animal well-being. But for many, the only available response was to endure. People learned to live with the disaster, to forget, even when they remembered, that they lived in an environment that had been permanently transformed by catastrophe. They were, as they always have to be, resilient in the face of danger. Resilience, I think, is the normal, then, the everyday response to catastrophe, the aim to get things back and running as they were. It's a necessary and a hopeful response, in some respects, particularly to those of us who fear for the future of a world that is apparently politically incapable of responding realistically to climate change. Yet at the same time, this resilience poses us a political problem. Arguably, it stood in the way of critical questions being asked about the impact of the incident. Why had it taken place? What were its long-term effects? One of the most interesting things, if you look at the whole Torrey Canyon disaster, is there's almost no long-term political impact in Cornwall that I can work out followed it. Most of our interviewees did not respond to the Torrey Canyon by becoming environmental activists, for example, or anything like that, although a few key ones did, and those are interesting exceptions. For many, Torrey Canyon was just another, if a bigger, marine disaster on Cornwall's shores, as easily forgotten as it was remembered. One might contrast this to other incidents, and I think the contrast is the important point, such as the Exxon Valdez disaster, where local communities, in the wake of catastrophe, organise and continue to organise to today for restitution and demanded recognition of the environmental and health impacts of the spill. In Cornwall, people were perhaps too resilient, if anything, too willing to go on with life once the immediate fear of economic ruin was past. This point is not meant as a criticism of the people of Cornwall. Rather, I think it is a pointer to the ways in which sustainability is as much a political problem as an environmental or social one. Ironically, the Torrey Canyon disaster showed Cornwall to have a very sustainable social system. Despite poverty and insecurity, despite an environmental catastrophe of long-lasting consequence, the people of Cornwall got on with living life. Today, there are no local movements for environmental justice built particularly around that experience, responding particularly to that. There are movements around environmental justice, but in terms of the particular response to Torrey Canyon, there isn't anything. Some local people found their way into environmental movements, but often cited the later role of organisations such as Surface Against Sewage rather than direct effects of the Torrey Canyon as part of this trajectory. And they're very explicit in being interviewed about that influence. Nonetheless, I would like to suggest that deep, hidden in our interviews, there were and still are critical questions about what sustainability might mean in the context of the Torrey Canyon disaster, but that they are questions that await a proper democratic space in which they might be addressed, or even for that matter, heard. Take this memory from one of our interviewees, and at this point, you get to use your hand. I won't name this chap, but I think this is a stunning intervention. To be honest, we'd never thought about a 100,000-ton tanker running aground. The same with nuclear waste being distributed around the country. It's just accepted, and nothing's made of it. You just accept it. We now think, well, moving that amount of oil, is it really a good thing? It's got to be done, because people need energy, people need heating, warmth, and so on. But there have been a number of ships run aground, oil tankers, especially up in the Orkneys, there's one, thinking about the Breyer disaster. Everything's got to be moved. It's nice to consider the environment, or you've got to consider the environment, but people need heating, people need lighting. But would you prefer to have tankers running around the coast? Or would you prefer wind turbines? Or would you prefer solar panels? I think I prefer wind solar panels to the wind turbines. And then we laugh. What I love about this response in the interview situation is its intellectual honesty. Its willingness to ask the question that is staring us in the face. What do we want? How do we want to reproduce or sustain, I would prefer the term reproduce, our daily lives? Do we want a global oil industry or nuclear power or wind farms? When you need to consider both the environment and people's lives, what is the right way to go about it? Yet in the end, as I think our laughter together here, we share this joke, indicates, we know these questions are a joke. A joke because though we recognise the question and the problem to be solved, we also recognise that no one is really going to ask us how to solve it, leave alone allow us the power to decide whether supertankers should be allowed to ply the high seas. That power of decision rests in the hands of transnational global corporations. We know that we have to be resilient to endure the potentially catastrophic consequences of this condition of things, because we are not offered another choice. We know, the interviewee and myself, that there is no democratic mechanism at present capable of allowing people to determine how we make and sustain both people and environment. Merely asking this question, or asking the right questions, of course, doesn't change these facts. But at least I think, and perhaps share with my interviewee here, the idea that it is a place to start.
Yeah, Stephen Horscroft, Cornwall Council. Do you think from what you're saying that resilience has almost become too personalised in the sense that, you know, we talk about resilience in a Cornwall context and there's some big issues around population growth, consumption of public services, how we pay for those things, as well as the environmental issues that you touched on. But also in terms of individual resilience, there's Wonga, there's food banks. They're not ideal, but almost people may think, well, I don't like that wind turbine there because it ruins my view. But in terms of what I need to consume, I can always find a way to consume. And it's some of those personal cultural issues that we need to tackle. Because we talk about Cornish culture, but actually there is a monoculture that operates in many people's houses and homes, whether they're in Truro or Timbuktu.
I suppose my response, and it's just the way that I feel about it, and I suppose the reflection that comes from talking to people like this interviewee and others like them, is that I would like to see it move beyond that personal question. I think the thing for me and from this interviewee, although we probably share slightly different views on how we would go about it, is we'd like to see these questions about what people call sustainability, what I would call social reproduction, how our society reproduces itself, goes from day one to day two to day three, become public questions, public democratic questions about making choices. Do we want an energy system as this chap here is asking the right question. What kind of energy system do we want? How do we want to produce energy? It's a real question. But, of course, where is the space actually for the public as a collective body to answer that question? It's very difficult, I think, to say exactly where that space is.
So if I'm right in interpreting this, perhaps what you're saying is that in terms of public policy debate and people who are in a position to influence that in Cornwall, they're not actually putting that to people. So we're kind of, you know, potentially hiding issues or not talking about what needs to be talked about? I don't want to put words into your mouth, but
want to go further than that. Yeah. I would like to see our politics organised in lines that it's not a case of going to people and asking what they want, but that they have the power to make a decision about how the energy system functions. What I would propose, and I'm not saying my interviewee would propose this, might have a different political view. What I would propose is that question about democracy, radical democracy, is the core question underlying these things.
What I mean is that people might not be thinking about that in the first place, and that you know, you've actually got to communicate some of these issues to people that you know, there's not particularly any money, there's not particularly any energy. Do you see what I mean? Is that people can live their lives without thinking about these challenges? And I suspect most people probably do, actually.
I would disagree with that.
I would profoundly disagree.
That's
with
a
that.
Debate.
I would suggest that looking at
this discussion.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
One,
I know. Yeah,
yeah. One more.
I hope you're right.
Just like to mention about community energy, particularly wind turbines, the work being done by Community Power Cornwall, which is local people investing in these things in their own area rather than big companies being brought in to do that. I would have thought cooperative method of going forward like that. Also on a slightly lesser scale, local economics lets groups sharing skills direct between yourselves rather than using the rather dysfunctional monetary system in the first place. Okay. Elements in going forward. Rob Follett, Falmouth Lets, Transition Falmouth.
I'm a participant in some of those projects myself,
right.
And I think they're important experimental projects in trying to do things differently. I was actually thinking myself about whether I should invest in Community Power Cornwall recently and decided against it. My fundamental problem being that it in some ways reproduces some of these problems is you get a say if you're a shareholder, but everyone in Cornwall should have a say in how energy is produced, whether they're a shareholder in a company, be it a cooperative or what, anyway, would be my position. So I decided not to invest in the end. But that doesn't mean those experiments aren't really important in trying to find different alternative ways to do things. I think they are.
Yeah.